Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Swim Podcast, episode number 12. The someone who isn't me on this one is Mr. Alan Moore, and I was really excited that this actually got to happen because I didn't think it would happen, to be honest with you. I kind of had a couple of mutual friends, but I didn't want to punish them about, like, sort of, oh, can you put me in contact with Alan and stuff, because it just would have been a bit weird. So I kind of fired off an email to somebody I didn't know who I thought would be a good point of contact, and after a few mails backwards and forwards with different people, we got to make it happen, which I was really excited about. So I packed up my Olympus recorder and a couple of mics, got on the train, went to Northampton, and went to the Lodge Studios in Northampton, which is an amazing studios there, and Jay and Mark, who run that place, let me set up in their incredible live room that they've got, and I chatted for over 2 hours with Alan about magic and writing, etc. Now, this episode is actually the first part of that conversation because I figured 2 hours was a lot to get through, especially as a lot of the stuff that was getting talked about was pretty deep and it was a lot to take in. So this is the first part. The second part is going to be up shortly once I've finished the cover portrait. And in this one, we discuss the creative process, magic, the morality in its application, taking in stuff like Austin Osman Spare and John Dee in the process of that. So this is Alan Moore, part one. Enjoy. I'd start off saying about what the thing is with the podcast is I've only started doing it in the last... I started in January.
Mm.
Because of the radio show I do, it's been so far, it's been mainly musicians. But I found that... I don't know whether it's because of my personal interest in things or just because it is a recurrent thing with a lot of people that make art and music, is that it always kind of ends up in a similar place where we start talking about where that comes from.
Yeah.
And how it comes about. And sometimes it feels a bit like not pulling teeth, do you know what I mean? Because a lot of people don't want to talk about it because they feel it like it makes them sound a bit...
Also, I believe that a lot of people, a lot of working artists, they have a kind of superstition about it. It's, I think Brian Eno said something similar.
Yeah.
That the last thing that most artists want to do is to examine their own creative processes.
Yeah.
It's as if they're riding a bike and they fear that if they stop and think about how they're actually riding the bike for more than a couple of seconds, they're probably going to fall off.
Yeah.
Or that if you mess around with it, it might stop working because we don't know what it is.
Yeah.
So we're going to be naturally afraid of sort of all of these because we're not sure what our creative processes actually are. We are subject to, I think, unnatural terrors and fears about them.
Yeah.
If we were professional drivers, say, if we were Chris Evans or someone like that, then presumably if you spent a lot of time driving, you would at least want to know the vague mechanics of what's under the bonnet, that if your car stops, you would want to know at least a few basic things that you could try to get it to start again. This must surely be the case with anybody whose life is dependent upon the creativity,
yeah,
that they can turn out. I mean, like... No, I've always thought that it's far better to try and understand those processes at as deep a level as possible.
I agree. Yeah, as I said, a lot of people will generally get around to a certain point, and then, you know, when you press that point to people and say, I believe that there is a certain degree of you're acting on things that are moving through you.
Well, it's kind of I remember that long ago when I used to attend conventions, there was one particular question from the audience that me and my fellow semi-professionals would single out for particular sneering and jeering, which was, where do you get your ideas from?
Yeah.
And we would heap scorn upon anybody who asked that and say, what a stupid question, because basically we didn't know.
Yeah.
We couldn't answer that question. And like I was saying, for creative people whose lives depend upon this, that has got to be a bit unnerving. You know, it's like being a farmer and having no clue as to how the weather works or how kind of crop rotation works or anything. Yeah, so, I mean, this was one of the things that led me at the age of 40 to start thinking about magic.
Yeah.
A bit more seriously. And to overcome some of my prejudices, perhaps.
See, this is the thing that I find interesting, is that you very famously said that on your birthday that you were going to declare yourself a magician. But surely at that point, wasn't it kind of a given anyway? And I remember you saying that a lot of people didn't really bat an eyelid. And is that, do you think that's because they were either like, oh, he's having a moment, or because it was already accepted that that was the case?
I don't think it was accepted that that was the case.
Okay.
But I would say that there are some grounds for saying that when you say something absurd and theatrical, such as I am henceforth a magician, that there will probably have been precursors. In fact, I realised upon starting to understand magic a little bit better, that I had been, that some of this stuff is fairly basic, or at least fairly basic to me, that some of these things I had been doing for years without realizing what they were. But to actually state that you are a magician, that's quite a big thing.
Yeah.
It's because, for one thing, you're putting everybody who you tell that to into quite a dilemma, because you're more or less forcing them to choose whether you've gone mad, which would be a very, very distressing thing for most friends and acquaintances, or that you haven't gone mad, which is potentially worse. Because if you haven't gone mad, then surely that forces them to reconsider their own definitions of sanity, reality, which is a bigger can of worms. I think I said that it was mainly people in my immediate family who didn't bat an eyelid.
Okay.
There was certainly quite a bit of eyelid batting in the general community, and probably understandably so, but people like my mother, my aunt, all of my aunts, they just seemed to accept it. I even got the feeling that it was a kind of a family thing that maybe happened every couple of hundred years, and it was nothing to get too excited about. I haven't got any direct evidence for that, but my paternal grandmother, my nan, who was a terrifying woman, her profession, at least earlier in her life, was a death monger. Death mongers, I believe, only existed, at least by that name, within the boroughs of Northampton. within that little area that I was born in, about half a square mile. And what a deathmonger was in a poor neighbourhood where you couldn't afford midwives and you couldn't afford undertakers. The deathmonger was the woman, it was always a woman, who lived down the end of the road or in the next street, who, for sixpence, a shilling, would come round and take care of all that. I think that the name deathmonger may have arisen, I'm not sure when it first came into currency. I suspect that it probably would have occurred when it was no longer safe to refer to people as witches. Because basically that was the function of the village wise woman or witch. It was largely childbirth, undertaking, herbal cures, things like that. This is possibly why the Guild of Barber Surgeons were so keen upon promoting the witch trials and the witch burnings, or the witch hangings, largely because they didn't see why it should be women who were in control of women's reproductive processes rather than the Guild of Barber Surgeons. So I suppose, in short, there may have been precedents in my family. At least the kind of belief that I was talking about didn't seem entirely unknown, you know.
It's wow, that's fascinating. Because I kind of I'd sort of reasoned it to myself that people would probably come to that conclusion somewhat anyway. But as you said, to actually make it as state it as a declaration, that's the thing, isn't
well,
it?
Well, it's one of the things that is empowering about that is that there is a considerable amount of risk involved. At that point, 1993, I had yet to do a lot of my, or yet to complete a lot of my major works. My reputation was by no means set in stone, and I was risking that reputation. Which was pretty much all I had. Because the most likely reaction to somebody saying that you're a magician, saying that they were a magician, is to say, do some magic then. And if you can't sort of pull the rabbit out of the hat, to say, well, in that case, you're mad or a fraud. So there is a certain amount of, a certain amount of risk. And that in itself is quite empowering because you are more or less saying, look, I'm serious about this and I don't care what the world thinks of me. I am going to do this whatever anybody thinks or says. That in itself is quite a statement, quite a declaration.
And it's really powerful.
Yeah, it's very powerful.
And then once you did that, that's when you started to... Were you aware of... You must have been aware of various... I don't know. Because I think magic nowadays is very much like the way it's approached. There's two ways, obviously. There's you know, you get your people which are following a very set tradition, you know, like, I don't know, like the Golden Dawn or whatever. But then you also have... through the 80s when you had through like music mainly, you had with bands like Coil and with Psychic TV, and where you had Topi, it just seemed like that opened the door for where it felt like it was a very punk rock thing, and like anyone could start practicing chaos magic, and it was like bricolage. Everybody was taking, I'll have a bit of that and we'll have a bit of spare and we'll have a bit of this. And what I meant was, you must have been, were you aware of all these things?
Well, I've been aware of magic since I was a 5-year-old child, but I had a 5-year-old child's conception of what magic was. As I got older, I realised that I was probably right the first time. 5-year-old children, I think, perhaps have an instinctive grasp of this kind of thing. So, yes, and when I was around 11, 12, I was reading the supernatural fiction of Dennis Wheatley, and I would contend, and I think Ian Sinclair would agree with me, 11 or 12 is the only age that you can read Dennis Wheatley and take him seriously without noticing all of the racism and the colonialism and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
Around that time, I became interested in a 12-year-old boy manner in the occult.
Yeah.
It lasted for about a year and didn't really yield much. I was aware of the contemporary occult scene, such as it was. I was largely aware of it through unusual sources, mainly through Joel Barocco's Chaos magazine.
Okay.
K-A-O-S. Joel Barocco is, I think, one of the most fascinating individuals on the magic scene. He's depending upon how he's feeling, he's a really good diabolist, quite seriously.
Yeah.
And there's not many people who, although they can talk about this stuff,
yeah,
there's not many people who can actually do it. I'm not saying that that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just saying it's a thing.
Yeah.
But Joel's Chaos magazine had a very, very irreverent approach to the magic scene itself. And he was perhaps not the biggest admirer of the Chaos magic movement, and that was an opinion that I think both myself and the late Steve Moore came to share with him. Okay. I mean, like, in our history of magic, the Lives of the Great Enchanters, old Moore's Lives of the Great Enchanters, that will be forthcoming in the Moon and Serpent Bumper Book of Magic, where we run through 50 of the most important, in our opinion, magical figures, whether they were real or not.
Okay.
Because there's really no difference, you know, or very little difference, in that they have contributed to the idea of magic.
Yeah.
But when we get to the 80s, we are quite critical of the Chaos magic movement. I mean, this is because you can see that it was almost symmetrical to the birth of the New Age movement on the other side of the Atlantic,
yeah,
but in the same time period, in the 1980s.
Yeah.
Both of these were largely concerned with practical magic, with actually effecting change in the material world.
Mm.
With the New Ages, it was largely asking the angels how to plan your teen witch slumber party. Generally, with the Chaos magicians, it, in practice, it would either be requests for money, or, I mean, basically, I have big problems with that kind of results-based magic anyway. I'm not certain that it is ethical.
Yeah.
In my opinion, that is treating magic as more or less a morally neutral force, like electricity. Whereas that is not my experience of magic. Hmm. Magic seems to have agency. There is at least the feeling, the sensation of a kind of presence and personality, sometimes of a sense of humour. I would say that in general, if you want money, do some work. If you want somebody to love you, then make yourself somebody worthy of being loved. Don't try and coerce supernatural beings into basically holding her down for you, because, I mean, Where's the morality in that? How is that not rape? And pretty much everything else that has a material, even if it's asking for help for a sick friend, yes, that's fine, but also go along and visit them. You know, do something practical in the real world. I believe that anything that can be accomplished with a bit of effort in the real world should be left to the physical material world. I believe magic is for the immaterial world. I shouldn't have said real world a moment or two ago. It's just something that you slip into occasionally. Both of them are real. And magic, it has, I think, as its concerns, I don't think that you should use this immaterial force or whatever it is to accomplish material ends. I think that that is almost classically satanic. I don't think it's a mistake that the Ten of Wands in the tarot deck, which is to say wands, which are the highest, most spiritual force, the will, being brought to bear upon the ten, which is Malkut, which is the material world. And that card is called Oppression. And it suggests that any large spiritual force brought to bear upon the material world is going to end in oppression and tyranny of one sort or another.
Well, I think just taking a look around the way things are at the moment, you could, that's very much a clear...
Absolutely.
...clear thing.
It's... yeah, and this is... Yeah, it's the root of all oppression. I mean, like... So... and also, some of the chaos magic stuff, I remember when Steve Moore briefly joined a chaos magic temple in South London. He didn't really get on with it well. He asked why the robes had to be black and was told that that was the most ignorant question that the questioner had ever heard. I suspect he didn't know. And also, Steve was saying that the kind of magical discourse in the group was largely, yesterday I did a sigil to see a black dog and then I saw one. Yes, I'm sure you did. And or some people asking how that, or suggesting that they thought they had an elemental trapped in their wand and didn't know how to get it out, to which Steve had said, well, look, firstly, are we sure that elementals exist? Are we sure that they can get trapped in wands? Is this causing you any problems that are kind of identifiable or discernible? So, yeah, he didn't last long in the chaos magic group. That, perhaps I shouldn't make a blanket sort of condemnation of the movement, but I have to ask how much it actually achieved. I can see that it was probably a necessary revolution against the leftover magical orders of the 19th century. At the same time, most of those magical orders were either disbanded or were having doing a pretty good job of attacking each other. I am not sure that the magical state, magic in England, I'm not sure that it's been in a particularly healthy state for quite a while. And I think... Sorry.
No, I didn't want to interrupt. I was just curious. Do you think that? Do you think that's because the people that that are approaching it are totally misguided, like you said, doing things for the wrong reasons? But then even Spare made like racing cards to try and
But
predict
he,
the horses.
He sold them. That was how he got money. By selling the racing cards that he'd done. Yes, they were an occult product. But it was a completely fair exchange.
Which is amazing as well when you think about it as well, isn't it?
I mean, like, Spare is astonishing. The more that you know about him, the more astonishing he gets. The less mythical he gets, but the more astonishing. I mean, I regard Spare's sigil magic as crumbs from his table, and of much less significance than Spare's astonishing artistry. With his illustrations, with his paintings, there is all the evidence that you could possibly need for the existence of the magical state.
Yeah.
Somehow miraculously captured, as if he'd taken a Polaroid in there with him. That is where the magic of Austin Spare resides. A lot of the myth of Austin Spare, which is a very entertaining one, a lot of that would seem to have perhaps originated with Kenneth Grant, who was a great romanticist in terms of his view of magic, and there is something to be said for that. It was a marvellous kind of almost like a fantasy role-playing game. I mean, Spare, an astonishing artist, an astonishing man, and one of the very few magicians who doesn't seem to have used his magic for material gain, who in fact famously said, I believe, that he believed that it would be wrong to use his talent to attract so much as a penny. Certainly from the way that he lived, which was like William Blake from choice.
Yeah.
Both of them were born into perfectly decent middle-class families, and both of them decided to live in the freedom that penury afforded. I mean, it doesn't get much better than Austin Spare. I would probably still place John Dee as the greatest British magus, but even John Dee, he wasn't above tapping up the Angels for a fiver now and again.
And that was a collaborative thing as well, obviously, with Kelly.
Edward Kelly.
Yeah.
Although Dee kept it up for a long time after Kelly had fallen out of the window, broken his legs when he was trying to escape from the Low Countries. But Dee, right to the end, I mean, his journals are poignant. Those final journals, his Prospero moment, when he was tended only by his surviving daughter and his spirits, the moment that Shakespeare wrote The Tempest about, you know, and in his last journal entries, he's asking the spirits what should be done about the blood in his stool, and the spirits are saying, I shouldn't worry too much about that if I was you. I'm paraphrasing, obviously.
Yeah.
And he was dead within a couple of weeks.
Wow.
You know, but even he occasionally, and he was an astonishing man, but even he occasionally did ask the angels if he could maybe have some petty cash to carry out their will.
Yeah. You know.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
But I do think that this movement towards practical magic that arose in the 80s, I would point out that wasn't the only thing that arose in the 80s, and that my friend, the writer John Higgs, he refers to chaos magic as Thatcherite magic. And I think that there is something to be said for that.
Yeah.
That the pursuit of material pleasure and hedonism, material wealth, how does that differ from Thatcherism as a doctrine, which, along with chaos magic, pretty much originated in the 1980s?
Yeah.
You know, and the New Age movement.
I've never thought those as a parallel. That's really true.
Yeah, I mean, Mike, in the Book of Magic, me and Steve, in the final essay, which was actually written after his death, but after we'd spent a few months compiling the notes towards the final essay, which is our thesis, I suppose. But in that, we come up with what we feel is a better definition of magic. We define magic as a purposeful engagement with the phenomena and possibilities of consciousness. We think that includes all of what magic was and all of what magic can be. It's perhaps not as inspiring as, or as resounding as, "Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law," or perhaps not as attractive as magic being bringing about change in the physical world in accordance with one's will. But I think we're more accurate, and I think that we're probably truer to the actual essence of what magic is.
And I think as well, when you accept that, then change comes about anyway, without it being a desired, like, I've got to do this, I'm going to draw this out and beat off over it because at this point I'm going to, you know, I'm going to get this. And but I think that if you acknowledge the existence of it and interact with it, as you said, then you know, you can look at it as synchronicities, etc., but that these things start.
The thing is, one of the things with magic that I've always found in practical terms is it's what I have come to define as high magic.
Yeah.
As I understand it, high magic is where you haven't got the faintest clue what you're doing. Where you are recognizing that the universe has probably got precedence and is probably quite entitled to pull rank upon you. It's not about what you want.
Yeah.
It's about what the universe wants through you.
Yes.
This is how creativity is best viewed. That the best creative artist should probably regard themselves as, at best, a clean window pane. If window panes were animate and conscious, and they probably will be in a Pixar film within this millennium, but sort of they might look down at the beautiful rectangle of golden light that they're casting on the floor and think, "Aren't I wonderful?" They might mistake themselves for the source of the light.
Yeah.
And I think that this is an analogy that holds true with artists.
Yeah.
That we are at best windows that let the light in, and probably the most that we can do is to try to be as clean as possible, and also to have a window with a useful vantage and of the correct width and height. Make it as big as possible. Allow it to let in as much light as possible.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that you're the son, you know?
Yeah.
It's a thing worth remembering.
That's great. It's very true.
I mean, like, the main... We came to a lot of conclusions about magic. Perhaps conclusions is the wrong word. We came to... We made some what we felt were interesting observations, especially in that final essay, which I don't want to entirely preempt, but
yeah.
The basic thesis of it is that magic, the original, the origination of magic, that would have occurred about 7,000 years ago, during what is known as the Cognitive Revolution. When we first started to get a handle upon language, and as modern language theory and consciousness theory assures us, language precedes consciousness, or at least consciousness of the modern kind. Before that, obviously, we must have had awareness. But it wasn't until we had language that modern consciousness happened. Now, the astonishing jump between that simple primordial awareness and the entire haunted palace that is the experience of modern consciousness. What must that have felt like to those human beings that were alive during that transition? It would have been all the voices in your head. Before you had a word for thoughts, all the pictures in your head, before you had a word for images or dreams, before you had a concept for consciousness, where could they have come from, if not from gods, from spirits, from supernatural forces? It seems like a pretty fair assumption to me. From that, we kind of... So magic was originally our way of understanding consciousness as a whole. It was our reaction to consciousness. And if language must have a precursor in representation, the idea that these marks on a cave wall or this sound somehow stands for that buffalo over there, that is art. In other words, so art must precede language, language must precede consciousness, and the experience of all of these phenomena was what we called magic. So magic was a one-stop shop of existence, basically. At least at its beginning, and at its core was ecstasy. The ecstasy was what was being evoked by the shamans and shamankas, and in doing so, they were creating almost the entirety of modern culture. Dance, theatre, painting, songs, music, all of these things.
Art.
As a way of altering the consciousness of the community, of evoking ecstasy. Now, what happens is time moves on and we start to change and we somehow get the idea of settlements. The agricultural revolution has happened and this makes urban dwelling possible for the first time. And once you've got urban civilizations, importantly, people don't have to grow their own food. This enables them to specialize. So you're going to get a priest caste emerging. That is going to set up formal religions, or at least the beginnings of formal religions. And that is going to take away all of magic's spiritual component. Then you're going to get those famous bastards, artists, writers, and musicians coming into existence. They are going to take away magic's visionary capacity.
Yeah.
But that's all right at first, because magic has still got science or natural philosophy. It's still got medicine. It's still got the inner world. So that ticks along fairly nicely until, what, the Renaissance? At which point science is cleaved from magic.
Because at that point they were running totally in parallel, weren't they?
Well, they were the same thing.
Yeah.
There was no distinction. John Dee was one of the scientists, one of the giants that Isaac Newton was famously standing on the shoulders of. He could not have done his work if Dee had not existed. Dee wrote the book upon navigation that made Britain probably, that gave it its famous British sea power. He wrote books upon mathematics. He was a scientist. And he also spent a lot of his life talking to beings that, for diplomacy's sake, he had to describe as angels.
Yeah.
So, yeah, all right, science and medicine, these are more or less taken away from magic to become parts of culture. So magic is limping along with the inner world. Oh, and it still has ecstasy, because that is the one thing that actually culture cannot assimilate. An urban settled culture has no place for ecstasy. It's the last thing you want. People becoming ecstatic, they don't do that according to a timetable.
Yeah.
It's spontaneous and it's socially disruptive. So you don't want ecstasy. The formal religions that started up with their priesthoods acting as intermediaries,
yeah,
between you and the gods, that is almost like a prophylactic to prevent you coming into contact with any of that ecstasy stuff. So yeah, we'd still got ecstasy, or at least those of us who knew how to conjure it, but other than that, we'd just got the interior world. And then, what, 1910, Sigmund Freud, Carl Jung, these people come along and, using ideas that have been commonplace in occult circles for centuries, they start psychoanalysis as a movement, which I have described to friends of mine who are psychiatrists, psychoanalysts. I've described their field as basically occultism in a lab coat, because it cannot be a science. It's talking about the interior world where things cannot be reproduced in a laboratory, where things are not really available for empirical proof. But yet the inner world was taken from magic as well, and then all it had got left was theatre. It had got the pretty frocks and the nicely painted wands and the rituals and the aura of spookiness.
Yeah.
You know, which I think has been what has attracted most people to it for, well, most of the previous century.
Yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah.
But it's funny that all of those, when you lay that out like that, I mean, you say about settlement and stuff, and you know, you look at all cultures, and it seems to be that there are these beings that are later interpreted as gods are the ones that have shown people architecture, shown people
I'm not even sure if they ever existed, except in an immaterial form. In my experience, that's what gods are. They are extraordinarily complex clusters of ideas,
yeah,
that have either become self-aware through the principle of consciousness as an emergent property of complexity, which I think is scientific,
yeah,
or they have become so complex that they appear to us to be self-aware. So also, I think importantly, one of the other things that we talk about in this essay, and this I have to say is purely me. Steve Moore was a little bit cautious about my assertion, although I was thinking about the origins of Christianity. I was talking about Christianity and Gnosticism.
Yeah.
And how, yeah, they both emerged at the same time and both shared an awful lot of key figures. And I put it to Steve that I said, could we say that Gnosticism predates Christianity? And Steve said he didn't feel that that was safe because we did not have any proof that that was so. But I thought, after he was safely dead and couldn't argue with me, I thought that sort of you could probably come up with an argument from common sense in that, say, some historical figure, now dead, but who we both know was definitely alive. Say the entertainer Rod Hull, for example. Now, if for some reason I was, let's say that I am the equivalent of a Christian in this argument, I suddenly think, you know, Rod Hull, I don't think he was just a great entertainer. I think that Rod Hull was actually the Son of God, and that an examination of Rod Hull's life would probably teach us an awful lot of profound spiritual lessons about what it is to be human. Now, I've said that for some reason. Then you, as a smart, sophisticated Gnostic, which by that point had already absorbed Pythagoreanism and Platonism, you step into the picture and you say, yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you that the figure of Rod Hull is a tremendously important spiritual figure. But you're going to propose that actually Rod Hull is a metaphor. At which point I would say, but no, he was a real guy. I'm definitely going to believe that he was a real guy. But you say, no, it's important that we see him as just a metaphor, which was the Gnostic position upon Jesus.
Yeah.
Now, how likely is that? If that would be a stupid thing to say on the part of the Gnostics in a century where this apparently famous man had died about 30 years before? It seems more likely that you had the Gnostics presenting their story of this symbolic saviour figure that had incorporated bits of Norse and Egyptian mythology into a broad spectrum of world mythologies had been incorporated into this figure, this symbolic figure. And yes, he's born of a virgin, and he ascends physically to heaven after his death on the cross. Now, it seems to make more sense if you've got somebody saying, yeah, this is our symbolic idea of what a saviour might be, and we think that by studying these symbols you might come to some form of enlightenment. And then the person that you're talking to says, yeah, and like, he was definitely born of a virgin, you say. And you say, well, no, not exactly. It's symbolic. And they say, yeah, I'm definitely going to believe that. So he was definitely born of a virgin. And like, he died and then he ascended. That's fantastic. I think that this is possibly how Christianity may have emerged as misunderstood Gnosticism from a religion that historically has been very literal in its kind of conception of reality. So this is one thing that suggests that idea forms probably precede the actual people, if actual people there were.
Yeah.
It's sort of, I seriously doubt that any of the gods existed in physical form, or any of the creatures that inhabit our world's various mythologies. It seems very, very unlikely to me, according to what we know of the laws of physics and biology. That just doesn't seem possible. And it doesn't really need to be. Because the domain of gods is the world of the immaterial. And that's the only place where they need to be. And they can obviously, I mean, look at all of the holy wars that have been fought. These immaterial ideas obviously have the power to affect our material world in quite drastic ways.
Yeah.
You know? Well, that makes me think of I heard you say in a previous interview about the idea of consciousness, and you were talking about Sheldrake, but that made me kind of think of like the sort of Jungian thing as well about like this collective unconscious. That as soon as those ideas exist, they do become real within the minds of the people that are thinking about them, and as you said, like if somebody has an idea about something, as soon as that idea exists, somebody else is going to have it as well.
Which kind of ties in with almost what we were saying about there is no need to have an objective to your magical practice. You can let the universe take care of that. And this also ties into what the final conclusion of our book of magic is, to say, with this process of magic having its various components hived off to become parts of society, what that is basically saying is that the entirety of our culture, we are conducting that among the dismembered body of magic. It's a dismembered corpse. Although, strangely, it still seems to be able to talk. And we thought that this is probably best seen as an example of the alchemic concept of solve et coagula.
Yeah, and the great work.
Yeah, that this is what it is all about. That sort of the principle of solve, it's basically analysis. It's taking the pocket watch to bits, to its smallest component, so that you understand how the whole thing works. And then there is the process of coagula, which is the process of synthesis. It's putting the thing back together in an improved or at least better understood form. And I think that as a civilization, we have probably reached the end of a very long process of solve. And I think that what kind of naturally has to happen is the beginning of a process of coagula, putting these components of what was originally a science of existence, a holistic science of existence, putting them back together in a better understood form into something that could once again be a central way of dealing with our much more complex existential world.
I agree. And I think that that's how I understand the alchemical process to be. You know, it's not about getting lead and turning it into gold. It's about, in the same way that, like, from a Masonic perspective, taking a rough ashlar and making it the smooth by taking symbols and using them as moral compass, not moral compasses, but just
as road maps as maps to higher realms of consciousness, or different realms of consciousness. It's on. I also think that there is something about magic which is conspicuously lacking from modern culture. Yes, we've got all the various dismantled parts of magic, but we don't have the essential animating ecstasy that was at the middle of it. We don't have vision in our art or in our writing. I mean, vision. We are sorely lacking in vision.
I think the worrying thing is, though, that, and I don't know if this is me putting my tinfoil hat on, but I that's something that I've noticed, is that the general populace, shall we say, are exactly, have no understanding or lacking the awareness to see those things, but other people do see that, and I believe that that's why they're using those things to a degree, so that people can be manipulated and pumped with fear. And
well, I mean,
do you think, or is that, like, I find advertising and the media is if they're not consciously looking at it as a form of magic, they still are using it as a form of magic.
Absolutely. I mean, like, I have said that, magic is in some measure the art of manipulating consciousness, hopefully manipulating consciousness into a higher, a more aware, a more ecstatic state.
Yeah.
However, the basic processes of it, you can manipulate consciousness for other ends.
Hmm.
And I suspect that, as you say, I doubt that our advertising agencies are actually reading up on Eliphaz Levi or anything else.
Yeah.
But I think that it is just that these principles have become kind of obvious and apparent.
Yeah.
I mean, we understand things like the placebo principle a lot better these days. We also understand that there is a nocebo principle. This is where you give people a sugar pill and you tell them that it may have side effects of nausea, headaches, vomiting, temporary blindness, whatever, and they will report exactly those effects.
Yeah.
It suggests that the mind is actually much more at the centre of our reality than we had supposed. We, in terms of our physical existence as creatures made of what Steve Aylett, the wonderful writer, referred to as haunted beef, then, I mean, like, with our physical bodies, that would seem, it seems to indicate that the division between mind and body is by no means as clear-cut as we'd previously believed, if it's there at all. In our physics, we have reached a point with quantum physics where quantum reactions apparently depend upon the observer, which of course begs a lot of questions, which I've just been reading about in this week's New Scientist. But still... this positions the mind at the very centre of reality. It's a kind of reverse Copernicus, I suppose you could call it, you know? And that would seem to be the way that the conclusion to which our science is moving, that, yes, we have stopped thinking that the whole universe revolves around the Earth.
Yeah.
But in some ways, our science tends to indicate that the whole of reality does revolve around the human mind, or is at least only apparent to the human mind, is entirely a phenomenon of human perception. Which, if that is true, then that goes a long way to explaining an awful lot of the processes of magic.
Yeah.
You know?
Thank you for listening to episode 12 with Alan Moore. That was part one of the conversation with him. The second part's going to continue along similar paths, but we discuss his novel Jerusalem, H.P. Lovecraft and more. So remember to subscribe on iTunes. If you leave a nice review and a rating, that will be, I'll be happy for a short while, but that's better than nothing. Right, so we're up to part 10 of Providence. And if you haven't been reading that, that's his latest comic. It's amazing. You need to check it out straight away. And you can pre-order Jerusalem online now. Hit me up at Daniel P. Carter on Twitter and Instagram. Like I said, subscribe, share the love, tell everybody about it. Part.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Two will be up very soon. Thanks a lot. Peace.